And so while you need nonprofit, the reality is, and it's unfortunate, nonprofit control just a very small amount of the capital in the world. And so the world is now saying, and this is a struggle that's happening out there today. The world is trying to figure out, how do you allocate capital within this investment and business world to influence good? The real question is what's your definition of good? And so that's the battle that's happening in the world today.
Welcome to the Generosity Now podcast, where we bring you inspiring stories of generosity and whole life stewardship. Our goal is to showcase individuals and organizations making a positive impact in our communities and across the world. I'm your host, Eric Most, president of the National Christian Foundation, Rocky Mountain Region. I'm joined by my marvelous co-host, Lori Bossert, VP in our office. Lori, how are you doing today?
Oh, it's a ton of fun. We get to have a super guest on and talk about impact investing. What's better?
That's right. On today's episode, we have the CEO and co-founder of Common Good Capital, host of A New Lens with Common Good Capital. Jeff is also on the board of Fortis Green Renewables. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So Jeff, give us a little bit about yourself. Tell us where you grew up. What was family life growing up? We always love to hear how people came to know the Lord as their Lord and Savior. And tell us about your family today.
So I've got to start out and just say it's fascinating to hear the format and kind of the question, because on A New Lens, we actually do very, very similar. So it's quite interesting. So I should be good at this. So let me tell you where I grew up. I'll go high level here. So I was born in California. Really, my formative years were in the state of Oregon. And I bring that up because since then, I've lived in Chicago area, lived back in Southern California, and now have lived in Orlando for 20 years. And so mathematically, I'm a Floridian, but my heart, and I hope I'm not offending any Floridians, my heart is really still on the West Coast. That's where I'm from, although we do love being here. So that's a little bit about, at least just geographically, where I grew up. And I'll just fill a few things in there. So we moved when I was a junior in college to Geneva, Illinois. My dad is still alive, but he was a cancer doctor, a radiation oncologist at the time. So moving my junior year in high school was quite challenging. The culture was different in Chicago than in Oregon, but I will tell you, it was a milestone in my life as I look back now, because it really forced me to come out of my shell and push me out of my comfort zone. And then from there, I went to Wheaton College. I was a double major in psychology and biblical studies. Lo and behold, graduate, go into the financial world, which is a whole other story because I had no clue that I was going to go into that world. One thing I would like to note, though, is when I was at Wheaton, I was a freshman. I went into a prison for the first time, not because I did anything, but it was a spring break trip. So I don't remember, maybe there's 8 to 10 of us, got in a van. We all drove down to Lake Okeechobee, which is in South Florida, and went into Glades Correctional Facility. What I didn't realize at the time is that God planted a seed in my heart for men and women behind bars. And so if you look at kind of my life in two tracks, I mean, you can do more than that because obviously my family's extremely important, but you have this financial side, financial services, and then you have prison ministry. I never have been full-time in prison ministry, but I've been going to prisons for the last 31 years and heavily involved, and that's a deep passion of mine as well. So I'll stop there, and then I keep going, but if you want to ask me any further questions.
Can you share a little bit of where Jesus interwoven in that with your family history and in your relationship?
So I'm going to take you back to when I was younger. I don't really want to talk about this, but I think it's part of the story, so I'm going to share this. I grew up in a Christian family. My mom and her side of the family actually goes back to being a woman at Wheaton College in the, I think, 30s, 40s, maybe 50s. I don't know exactly. And there is a dorm named after my great-grandmother. And still on that side of the family, my grandparents were heavily involved with Polar, I think they were on the board and whatnot. So you kind of have that side. And then my dad's side, he grew up in Bakersfield, California. They too were believers, probably more on the fundamentalist side. But I want to set the stage there because I grew up in an outwardly and inwardly Christian family. So I was always raised in that. But behind closed doors, there was abuse that was happening, specifically toward me. Once I left, metaphorically, when I was 18, 20, whatever, that abuse went towards other family members. But what's important is that shaped my life in a number of ways. But one of the things it did is from a coping mechanism, I had to put a wall around my heart. And that was a great coping mechanism at that age. We'll get to this later, but when I'm 40, that's not a good coping mechanism. But you just need to know that I had to put a wall around my heart that also probably impacted clearly my view of God. But when I was in eighth grade, I went to a basketball camp. I played basketball. I accepted Christ, I think, when I was 4 years old at a Good News club. But ultimately, probably when I was in eighth grade is really when I made a decision and it became more real. But then I will tell you, it was at Wheaton College that I wrestled with it. As being a psych major, being a biblical studies major, trying to integrate the two, I'd come out every class and my head would be spinning. I'm like, oh, how do you fit all this stuff together? Meanwhile, my wife, who wasn't at the time, you know, for her, it's like, oh, she was a literature major. Isn't this fun? And I'm like just racking my brain. But I will tell you, I came out of Wheaton with this. I broke it down to its simplest form. And you got to understand, I'm a guy, not that I'm smart, but I like to think about stuff. And so I probably just pinned myself into a box. I just overwhelming thinking about it. But here's where I left Wheaton. Is Jesus who he said he is? And do I believe it? Then I'll go love God and love your neighbor. All the other ancillary stuff, I still wrestled with it, but ultimately I'm like, I don't care about all the other stuff. It's that simple. Either you believe that, accept that he is who he said he is, or this thing is all crazy. So that was very formative for me, very challenging. And then when I was 40, God peeled the onion back one more time. And that's where I'd say there was an I'm sure more onions or layers will be peeled as I continue to grow older. That's where complete surrender came in. So I've been a Christ follower my whole life. And over the last, I'm 50 today, it's like the layers just slowly keep coming off and keep going deeper, which kind of scares me because I don't know what the next layer is. Because you see there's pain in that process, but that's where I'm at.
But Jeff, I would say that's probably true for all of us. I mean, God doesn't let us stay where we are. He is constantly going to take those layers off and deepen us each and every, you know, day, month, year. I do think that that's where the wisdom comes from over time.
Yeah, you talked about, we met a few years ago, Jeff, and I remember taking some notes and just remember our conversation. You talked about how impactful this time was, that God took your faith to another level when you were 40. And you've already alluded to it a little bit. You talked about how he was calling you to a different focus, a focus to engage your time, talents, and treasures in a different way. Would you share more about that?
Yes. So let me set the context. And this is not to be egotistical, but I think you need to understand where I was at to where I went. So look, I was in the financial services industry. I had been at 40, I'd been in there, so call it 18, 19 years, whatever the exact math is. And from a worldly perspective, I had a big old job. I had a ton of influence. I was making a lot of money. But what I didn't realize is that I was driven to perform. And I was married to work, said another way, work was my God, but it really was about performance. And it wasn't so much that I cared what my colleague thought. Sure, there was some of that. It was this inner drive to fill a void that I already alluded to you, you know, some of that earlier, which I didn't know this at the time, but I was driven to perform. So early in my life, it was academic and it was athletic. And so again, from a worldly perspective, I did quite well in those things. Well, when I was 40, on top of the world from a worldly perspective, about 12 to 15 things hit me all at once. Some were personal, some work-related, but the culmination was a back surgery. And the metaphor that I would give you is, I was on this treadmill, not only at work, but probably just in my own life in general, this treadmill, and you can't see this, but picture the treadmill getting steeper and steeper and steeper. And I'm holding on to the front of it, and I'm walking up this thing. And the image that I had was, not that I'm smarter than anybody, but I probably would have said, I'm going to outwork you and put it on. Whatever it is, put it on me, I'll carry it. The world paid me for that loyalty. The world lifted me up for that addiction. And I wasn't going to let go. There was clearly pride there. I wouldn't have called it that. I thought it was loyalty. So metaphorically, in a 3 to 4 week time period, I went into such severe back pain. And I had struggled with this for a while. I mean, for years. And it came to the point where I kind of had not emergency surgery, but literally by the day, I'm feeling the strength leave my leg. So like I'd walk upstairs and I'm like, this is getting harder to walk. And so anyways, turns out a physician who I'd met on a flight a year earlier happened to sit next to him with a back surgeon. A year prior to that, he's like, you don't need back surgery. You'll know when you need it. By the grace of God, he ends up, he's following me at this point. He finds out where I'm at in the state that I'm in. He comes home early from his skiing trip. It's over Christmas time, and we go have surgery. When I woke up from that surgery, it was as if God had taken a 2x4 and physically ripped me off of that treadmill. And I metaphorically, literally ended up on my back with a broken back. And it was as if I could literally feel the adrenaline leave my body that had been storing up for the previous 40 years. Now, when I say I saw the world different, I saw trees, I saw everything else, but it's like I saw a whole nother dimension, and I don't mean it weirdly. And my desire to be at work doing what I was doing was completely gone. Now, mind you, I had surgery on a Friday and I went back to work on Monday. So I'll just tell you, it was this crisis of, for the first time, physically, I may not be able to do this. And so I had to wrestle for the first time that I have limitations. Fast forward 2 weeks later, they had given me so many steroids 6 weeks prior to not have surgery. Of course, I then have surgery, they give you steroids, and then I'm having steroids afterwards. I end up in a state, and this is for a whole nother deep dive. I end up in the emergency room 2 weeks after in what's called steroid psychosis. Now, I didn't know what steroid psychosis was. It was as real what I was experiencing as me talking to you today. But I will tell you the outcome of that was twofold. One, again, God then stripped me of my mental capacity for 12 to 24 hours. During that 12 to 24 hours, though, and I remember most of it, some of it I don't completely remember, but it was as if I was in the world and things weren't, I could see them, but they weren't real. And so the ultimate feeling is, if I was trapped in this world / universe, but I was completely alone. Said another way, the absence of God. Those two things in a 2 week time period drove me literally to my knees. And for the next 9 months, And I never knew what anxiety was. For the next 9 months, I am on my knees an hour every morning just to function. And that became a catalyst for what seemingly today is the next or the last or the second chapter of my career and life.
What a truly impactful scenario that you went through. And that then transitions to today. So not, you know, still in the financial world, but in a very different manner. Common Good Capital. How about you give us an overview of what Common Good Capital is, the work that you do, and what are you seeking to achieve?
Okay. So I'm going to take you back to that scenario a little bit because this is where it was all birthed. So let me take you 5 weeks post back surgery now. So I just told you the scenario, what was happening. So I'm sitting at a couch in our house. I am working, but I'm now working from home. And I remember sitting there and I plugged in a investment DVD. My wife and I were gonna do some investing. So I happened to plug this in and it was a fund that was investing in affordable housing in the Southeast. So what they would do is they would buy these properties. A lot, at the time, a lot of them were Section 8 houses. They were poorly run down. They would buy them, infuse them with capital, fix them up, and then change the management. And their focus was loving on these residents. So you got to remember, I've got a big job. I mean, at the time, we're probably supposed to be raising $1.5 billion to go into these funds, real estate funds or whatnot. So here I am at the same time looking at this investment. Well, two residents shared on this little video what it was like living in this community prior to this group coming and buying the asset and then putting a new manager. And one of them said, they've given my dignity back. And I remember sitting there and like, oh, wow. The next one came on and said, and by the way, they talked for maybe 20 seconds each. The next one said, yeah, and now I'm so excited to have people come to my house. And I knew what he meant or she meant, I don't remember. But you're like, it's an apartment. And that's when the light bulb went on for me where I'm like, wait a second. Investing has an impact, it has an impact on people's lives, whether you care or don't care. And so when you think about investing your capital for the benefit of others and yourself aligning with your values, and you bring your heart into this equation, you can radically change people's lives. So that was like a light bulb went on. And actually, probably 5 years prior, it solidified stuff that I had been thinking or God had been putting in my mind, but I didn't really put it all together. But here's the other thing that happened out of that. So most people talk about impact investing, faith-driven investing, aligning your investment capital to do good, to bring the kingdom here on earth. But what my wife and I experienced for the first time, because my wife, does she care about investing? Not really. She's open, you know, learns. But when we made this investment and we start to see that our capital is not only making money, but it's also benefiting these residents in a very, very significant way. My wife got involved. She was interested in what's going on. And we started to experience what I would say joy and freedom. And those are not terms you normally talk about in the investing world. Emotions that typically come in the investing world are fear and grief, but that's because you're holding on tightly. So once we surrendered that and started looking at our own value set and the value set and how it's impacting others, then we experienced joy and freedom. So it was out of all of that it became clear, there's this whole thing called impact investing. Now, back in that time, it still was a relatively new term. So there was moments where I'm like, am I nuts? Is this thing actually legit? So fast forward, I finally left that company where I was at. And this is an interesting story. I told the CEO, who was a very strong believer, hey, I'm going to go do impact investing. And his first comment, and he probably doesn't remember, his first comment is, Jeff, I question your theology. And I remember going, I went into place, I didn't even argue. Whatever. So it was out of that was the catalyst and to create Common Good. So we created Common Good. because we saw what was happening in the marketplace. And that is that investors are increasingly want to align their values on the investing side to make money and do good. But in the world that I come from, the financial world, often the gatekeeper to making that happen are wealth advisors all across the United States. They control the majority of money in the world or in the United States. So we said, let's just take what we've been doing, what I've been doing as a career for 20 some years at that point, and shift it over to impact investing. So we source due diligence and ultimately educate wealth advisors to help them think about investing differently, to bring in their values, to bring in their heart, and to have these discussions with their investors so they can start to unlock more and more capital, not only to go to all these different things that need it, but also to hopefully unlock some joy and freedom in the lives of investors. Because we know where your treasure is, your heart will follow. And so we believe if we can get more and more people to align and think about their capital more intentionally, we actually will open their hearts towards whatever they're investing in.
Love the transition, love the work that you're doing. And thank you for that overview of, it is a beautiful way to think about that, the joy and passions that can get ignited as we start investing for purpose. And so, love, I mean, you know, not looking to share, you know, inside tracks of investment opportunities and things like that, but like, what are some of these look like? Some of the investments that you're even working with on some of the investment advisors and all.
Yeah. And so I'm going to say one other thing too, because it's, it's positionally where I'm called to be. So impact investing is a broad term, which we already just talked about, but there also is a subset of that, which you would call faith-driven investing. Now, I don't know, this is for a whole nother discussion. I don't know where the line is between impact investing and faith-driven investing. Some is clear. Some I get into arguments where it's not so clear, but it doesn't really matter. I feel called to not only be in the faith community, which is who I am, but I actually feel called to be in the secular world. So for me, it's about creating commonality between maybe some who don't have a faith and some who do. And it's also speaking in parables. So I don't feel called just to sit in the faith community, although I'm happy to help there. I feel called to go in the mainstream and quote unquote, fight a bigger fight. Saying that, let me give some examples of things that we have done over the last 8 years. And some of this we do through partnerships. So it's not that we necessarily experts in every area. So we have done stuff in affordable housing that translates down into apartments, as you would think about, but it's also gone all the way down to mobile home community as well. So that would be, and basically in both those scenarios, you are investing, you're a landlord, and you are surrounding those residents with services that probably go above and beyond traditional, you know, investment mandates, whether it's having a chaplain there, whether it's getting nonprofits to come in and meet the needs specific to those. It's a much more intentional thing. It's not just driven by financial. You're putting other metrics involved. We've done stuff on environmental stewardship. So in the Pacific Northwest, there's an opportunity in the past that was buying timberland and it's slowing down its production and providing, basically going in and creating value in timberland that traditional timber owners weren't going to mess with, for example. We've done stuff. So there are pockets of areas, whether it's in the U.S., whether it's outside the U.S., that don't have access to capital. It's very hard to. So we've done some stuff lending to what's called SMEs, small to medium-sized enterprises outside the United States. They often are lacking capital, so we've done that. I'm involved right now with I'm actually a director in a fund that invests in renewable energy in Africa. I always have to explain this because, you know, some people take this environmental issue and view it one of two ways. Fundamentally, half of Africa doesn't have access to power, 600 million people. And so we are providing, trying to bridge the gap and bring power. It turns out in most of the cases, the most economical option and frankly, the best environment is renewable. So we're doing that kind of thing. And then lastly, and there's plenty more, but I have a deep passion, as I already mentioned, for formerly incarcerated. So this is not available to the masses, but my wife and I are experimenting and learning because one day we would like to be able to allow people to invest in this. We've been investing in businesses that are run by or hire formerly incarcerated men and women. And then in fact, right before this call, my wife and I are looking to partner with a ministry that performs transitionary housing, healing, mentorship to men getting out of prison. And so we're actually looking at owning some real estate that they would rent from us in a dual mandate type scenario. So those are just some of the examples.
And those examples are so helpful because it does give people understanding of what those impact investings and how wide they can be, because they're in all different types of sectors, in all different parts of the country, here in the U.S., overseas. And the impact to the people is really what makes it that different type of investment. It's not just the returns that they're going to get.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the reasons we started Common Good, there is no good place for investors to go to even see what are all the potential options like this that are investable. Now, we don't have we don't profile them all. And eventually I do think that this will be more of an opportunity, but more and more funds are becoming available that fit within this genre. And it's actually really, really exciting. Because the world knows that most of the capital is tied up in business and investment. And so while you need nonprofit, the reality is, and it's unfortunate, nonprofits control just a very small amount of the capital in the world. And so the world is now saying, and this is a struggle that's happening out there today. The world is trying to figure out how do you allocate capital within this investment and business world to influence good. The real question is what's your definition of good? And so that's the battle that's happening in the world today.
Well, that's such a great segue to actually a question I was looking to ask you, Jeff. You know, one thing that you've done with Common Good Capital is help NCF actually with some due diligence on some impact investments. And we've talked a lot about impact investing here in this episode and also along the way on the Generosity Now podcast. And so I wonder if you'd give our listeners some frameworks that they could or should consider employing when they're evaluating an impact investment that good, as you just were talking about.
Yeah. My career has been predominantly around private investments, which means, and I have been on the other side, which is public stocks and public bonds. So predominantly what we're talking about is private. Because they generally are illiquid, you have to think about these that you are marrying them as opposed to dating them. So if you go buy a stock on the stock exchange, you buy a mutual fund, metaphorically, you're dating that investment. Because if you don't like it 2 weeks from now, you go sell it. On the private side, you're generally going to hold these things for a while. So it comes to the point of due diligence becomes really important because you're getting into a trust relationship, oftentimes 3, 5, 7, 10 years down the road. So we look at the manager or the sponsor. So whoever is investing this on your behalf, we're going to do a deep dive to understand what's their background, what's their history, what's their experience. So that's kind of one area we're going to look at. Another area we're going to look at is the fund and the thesis behind that specific fund, the investment thesis. So embedded in that is, okay, what is this fund looking to buy? What are the parameters? What are the guidelines? What's the process? What's the investment opportunity that they're investing into? And in addition to that, we're going to look at, okay, so how is this fund structured? This is a piece that most people, I mean, and I wouldn't have the expertise if I just, you know, started doing this myself, but the legal structure and how this thing, it makes a difference. And so that's why you have professionals who are looking at this. And I won't go in depth in that, but the legal structure is really important. And then the last piece, and I don't say last is the least important, is we look at the impact, or said another way, the faith integration. And let me highlight that for a second. We believe there needs to be intentionality. What we mean by that is we know there's intentionality on the investment side. At least there should be. Otherwise, it's not very sustainable. But we want to know, what's the intentionality of driving impact? What are those goals? Do you actually have stated goals of what you're trying to impact? And then are you measuring those goals? And then are you being transparent? If you don't do those three or four things, it's not that you're not an impactful manager, an impactful fund, but we don't think it's best class, because you should be measuring this stuff. You should be reporting on it. Just like on the performance investment side, you may find out 2 years from now that you're not getting the impact that you want. Well, you need to be honest about that, and then you need to go try to fix it so that you can. So impact investing really should be driven about, we want to make a difference. And if we're not making a difference based on outcomes, then we need to check ourselves, because something is not correct or our thesis is not right. So high level, that's how we think about it. I think as an individual investor, the other thing that needs to be thought about is, do you invest in this through your DAF capital? Do you invest in it through your investment capital? What is your risk tolerance? Do you want to invest in a company? Do you want to invest in a fund? I will tell you, from 27 years of doing this, most investors should not be investing in one company in a direct. It's too risky. Now, I'm not saying you can't. And as soon as I say that, I do some of that. But most investors should be investing in a fund that has multiple things in it. So if one of them doesn't work, or two of them don't work, the whole fund doesn't blow up or doesn't make sense. Then the last thing is, you need to think about, what percentage of a portfolio should be investing in this? And that's obviously a discussion you're going to want to have with the professional, because there's illiquidity to them, and there is risk. But mind you, there's risk in every investment you make. In fact, you're taking a faith every time you make an investment, but the reality is you don't think of it that way, but you are, just like you are on the impact side.
And Jeff, just trying to tie some of these pieces together, you talked about that you work with faith financial advisors, but also non-faith financial advisors. So all of these financial advisors could find these funds that if they wanted to do these investments, either with their charitable capital or their just investment capital, these funds are available to people through their advisors.
That's the goal. Yes. And in, yes, that's how it works. Part of what Common Good is trying to do, and others, we are trying to unlock more and more advisors and their firms, allowing this to happen so that discussion can be had at a bigger scale. So not everyone is set up to do this, but over time, that will become more and more of the norm.
Perfect. Yeah. And one thing you were talking about earlier is some of these deals are also private deals, and more, you know, accredited investors, qualified purchasers, you know, is kind of the entry point. And where we've also talked about, that's also where, and we're not suggesting that everybody takes all of their charitable capital and go into a risky investment here, but that it does open up the door for more availability, even for non-accredited investors to get involved in making an impact with some of their investments through things like the Impact Foundation, or some funds that are available that have already been approved for charitable investments, which is really a beautiful thing.
And here's another thing that's happening in the world. So totally agree with you. The financial world is wrestling with this. The nonprofit world is wrestling with this. And I'd be curious your thoughts, because you live with donors, investors all day long. But I believe, and I'm seeing it, but I believe in a big way going forward, whether it's the NCFs of the world, whether it's a financial advisor of the world, that person that you're talking to is both a donor and an investor. And they want to be, they're going to need to be talked to holistically. So to some degree, they find things they're passionate about. They should and will want the flexibility to say, all right, that one, I want to do on the charitable side. And it could be a grant, or it could be I want to invest in that. And others are going to say, but I also want to do that on my investment side. So that's what's exciting as we start to engage more and more people as a whole human being. I think you're going to see a whole lot more capital flowing into this genre, whether it's charitable capital, whether it's traditional investment capital.
Yeah, actually, in fact, the episode that just dropped on April the 4th on our podcast with Molly Sippity and Parker Samuelson, they were talking about this exact scenario. And these are two Zillennials, young, kind of, they bridge the gap between Millennials and Gen Z. And they actually, Parker talked about this time that each one of them received a reach out from this nonprofit, and they were all kind of ghosting them. And finally he's like, and they were all like kind of talking, this a group of friends, like, hey, did you guys get this, you know, plea? And they're like, yeah. And they said, Parker reached out, and he talks about this, and you can go back and listen more about that. But he says, like, reached out, cause I didn't want to ghost the guy and say, hey, I actually think that what you're describing would be a better investment than it is a charitable grant. And if you can go and set up the model, like I actually think, like, and have a, like you said, have a compelling thesis that makes sense, then we would most likely invest in you. And I think you're right. There is a shift for some types of organizations that have been currently relying on purely charitable grant capital that need to think about different streams and how they can activate investment capital as well.
And I do think it's a shift in our culture. You know, as you alluded to, Jeff, this is new. You know, you haven't been doing it your whole career. It's a new sector. And that's why we're trying to educate people. And truly, the charities are, I believe, are going to catch up in this space of being able to see some of this impact investing and how they want to join this whole movement. I certainly see it on the giver side of, we continually have more and more conversations with people about doing the impact investing.
So let me give you an example where at a project level, where a nonprofit is leveraging charitable capital and investment capital. So in this fund that my brother and others and myself, I'm a part of, manage, we have an agreement, we have a signed agreement to buy a solar farm that's sitting on top of, an orphanage on the land that they own. So the orphanage is next to it, essentially. Well, what they realize, and it's brilliant, this orphanage, it's amazing. It's called Agahosa Shalom. I could talk about it for an hour. In fact, I was over there 4 weeks ago. I'll go back over in 3 weeks. But here's how this was set up. So I think in 2016, 2017, the board of Agahosa Shalom realized, hey, we've got this land that we can either sell, or what if we wouldn't create a revenue stream off of it? So essentially, they went to an institutional investor. This institutional investor built a solar farm on it. And then I think it's a 99-year lease. So we're actually in the fund going to buy that asset. But here's how this works. We'll buy the asset, our investors in the fund. We'll get the revenue from generating the solar power. And then we will, as part of the agreement, we will pick up and pay rent every year to the orphanage. And it's like $200,000 or whatever. It's 10% of their operating budget. And so there's a scenario where this nonprofit is, you know, they have charitable capital coming in and they still need that, but they've created a sustainable model to an investment. And so they get rent for the next 95 years. And so that's some of the creative thinking that is going on. And it's really exciting to see that happen. Plus, as an investor, you still get your return, but then you know that it's also helping the orphanage. So it's like, oh my God, what a great way to do this thing.
Love that example. I think examples really help people understand and think and dream. I love to think about some of the NCF givers that could be listening to this and other people as well, and have a deep passion for an organization, maybe here locally, or someplace globally, and think about, man, how can I, you know, I'm this business guy or businesswoman and you know, how do I make the work that they're doing more sustainable? And like having access to even some of these ideas can catalyze some significant impact around the world. I think it's wonderful. So thank you so much for sharing.
You know, if you don't mind, this is actually a plug for NCF and what you all do in a creative way. And I'm not going to take credit for it, but I got to be a part of it. So there's a ministry that I'm deeply passionate about. It's actually called Nehemiah Project. They teach biblical entrepreneurship around the world. I'm very good friends with the founder. He's from Cameroon. And so my wife and I give charitably to him. We also host a lot of people and whatnot. But one of the things that we figured out was that they needed additional forms of capital. Now, if they could get all the capital they wanted through charitable, you know, they would take it. So one of the things that we did is we created, and we actually went through Impact Foundation. We essentially said, hey, I've got this chunk of capital. Let me loan it to you. And you know, the interest rate's extremely low. And so for him, we not only give grant, but then we, you know, an impact investment. In this example, it's concessionary. We're not trying to drive market returns. But he's able to use that in his nonprofit, and it's a loan, and it's much cheaper than he would get elsewhere. And so even that's a unique little nuance of just being creative to help this nonprofit. And actually, I just told him, I've been doing that for maybe 4 to 5 years. I just recently told him, you know what? I'll renew half of that loan this year. The other half, I'm actually going to grant it to a prison ministry. And so he was fine with that. But those are some of the creative things that you can do.
And that's using your charitable capital more than once, which is what I think is just phenomenal, is using it as a loan, helping a business grow, helping a project grow or a charity, and then getting it back and being able to either do that same thing again or granting it again.
Yeah. Hey, Jeff, you've been around in the financial world for a long time with your career, as we've heard, and you've been in this impact investing world, and you come alongside NCF as an organization and individuals and all. So I wonder if there's something that you wish our listeners knew about generosity and stewardship and investing that we haven't hit on yet, that kind of has a kind of more of a closing thought.
Yes. First of all, I don't have all the answers. and I've been on my own journey. And it is actually quite interesting because I'm friends with Todd Harper, who, for those who don't know him, he's generous giving. And then actually a friend of mine is Tim Seneff, and he is or was the local president of NCF Orlando. So they were along that journey with me. But let me give you two quick thoughts. The first is, and this might offend some people, so on one hand, I'm okay with that. But I hope we could just listen to this for a second. I would encourage us to think more broadly around generosity and why are we called to be generous. And I'm not going to go through all those reasons, but I think it's an interesting discussion. Part of it's a heart issue. Part of it is because there's a commandment. Part of it is to make a difference. But one of the things I would love to see happen in the faith community is that we would not, and I'm going to take the tithes to the church off the table because I don't think that's negotiable. But granting or giving to nonprofits are a wonderful thing. Keep doing it. But often I would say our knee-jerk reaction is that by granting capital to that nonprofit ministry is by definition more holy than making an investment into something that's working or trying to combat that same issue that the nonprofit is. And I would just want people to stop and think that in making an investment in a cause or area that you're concerned about actually might have a bigger, more lasting impact than that charity. And I know that's almost sacrilegious to say, because I don't want to disparage charities, but I think we need to challenge what generosity ultimately includes. And then the other thing tied into that is this, and this is black and white. It doesn't mean that everybody does it this way, but I'm going to say, I think generally people do. In the church, tithing is probably more of a discipline. You know, you pick whatever number that you're supposed to give, and you're being faithful and you're being obedient. That's amazing. That's wonderful. But that really is a discipline. Now, there are plenty of examples of people who take it, and it's more than discipline. It is like complete surrender. But I'm going to challenge and say, on the investing side, which means it's probably what left for you and your family, and it's what you hold on to. When you think about investing open-handedly, that, and you could lose your own quote-unquote capital, that's faith. Not that there's a faith in giving. It probably just depends on how much you give. But it takes real faith to take your own capital that you're going to use, that you're going to count on 25 years from now, and to say, I'm going to align it with my values. And then to me, the lesson that I've learned and some days I live this out, and some days I start to get tight and greedy. But as I left my first career to do impact investing, because I was trained, protect the downside. In the financial world, if you don't protect the downside, you're being a poor steward. Well, when you read the parable of the talents, for me, my takeaway is none of this is mine anyways. So if I'm being called to take risk, even though that it may be outside your risk to everybody else looking at it, I need to be obedient. And the outcome is not left up to me. Now, that does not mean throw caution in the wind, do stuff stupid, because I think it's an individual calling. But for me, investing in men and women who are formerly incarcerated, I can't tell you how many times I've been in the due diligence process. And in my world, if they've got a criminal background, you're the first thing you do, you rip it up. You can't invest in them. And here I am, not because I'm holier than thou, but because God's called me to do this. I'm like, wait, you're an ex-felon, but are there more? Because I want more people to be in there. And there's moments where I'm like, what in the world am I doing? Is this crazy? In fact, I had the pleasure, you know, it didn't feel like it about 2 weeks ago. I had a pleasure investing in a man, and my wife and I did this, who was waiting for his sentencing. So he was in limbo land for the last 6 years. He calls me up 2 months ago and says, I'm going in front of the judge. And this happened like 2 weeks ago. So he went in front of the judge 2 weeks ago to find out, am I going to prison or not? Meanwhile, I'm sitting here back going, I just wrote a check over the last whatever for X amount. He goes to jail. That thing probably, or prison, probably goes to zero. And I had to come to realization of, nope, I did it because I was called to do it. I wasn't being a bad steward. I was being faithful. And I think at times it'll work and at times it won't, but I'm trying to live out in obedience despite how it may look to others.
Jeff, that is just absolutely wonderful to hear of how God has really convicted your heart in that space. Because as you said, it is truly all God's, and truly the outcomes are God's in those investments and in the granting of into charities. It is, God doesn't need our money. He needs our hearts, and he needs our obedience, as you talked about. On the Generosity Now podcast, we seek to inspire and equip and connect our listeners for generous kingdom impact and whole life stewardship. For more information on us, please check us out online at ncfgiving.com/Rocky Mountains and generositynow.org. Please go ahead and subscribe to our podcast, leave us your review, and share with your network. Our doxology today ties in exactly to what you were talking about, Jeff, that it's from the parable of the talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things, and I will put you in charge of many things. Enter the joy of your master." Jeff, thank you so much for sharing with us today about your joy and how God has brought you on this journey and how each one of us is just called to journeying with God in this space.
And Jeff, we're going to go ahead and connect people in our show notes to you, Common Good Capital and Fortis Green and other things. And so there'll be ways for the people to connect. And thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Well, I love what you're doing. And so thank you. This what I love is you're talking to people who are actively risking and making a difference. And hopefully you are catalyzing more and more people to step out in faith. So kudos to you all.
Amen.
Thanks.